Okay, we'll call to order the Judiciary Committee meeting on Monday, the 22nd of February at 12 minutes after 1. We're on teleconference and I didn't switch my button. In any event, we have an ambitious calendar that we'll try to get through. We have three bills which purport to be of not too long a duration of testimony. I would like very close to 1:30 to take up HB 100. So those that are here to testify on HB 120, 151, and HDR 15, please keep that in mind. 100, of course, we've set off once already, and I have people on teleconference waiting to testify and do not want to inconvenience them again. Without further ado, I would like to take up HB 151 and ask Chris Christensen from the court system if he would come forward and talk to us about that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, staff counsel to the Judicial Branch. As you'll recall, HB 151 was introduced by this committee at the request of the Supreme Court. Briefly, under both the U.S. and state constitutions, a criminal defendant has the right to an attorney. If he can't afford an attorney, one has to be provided for him by the state. In Alaska, these appointments are generally handled by the public defender and the Office of Public Advocacy. Up until 1990, AS 1885-120C provided that a court could order an indigent defendant to pay for their defense services to the extent that the defendant could afford to pay. For a variety of reasons, the statute was very ineffective in obtaining any kind of a repayment of defense costs from indigent defendants. Probably the biggest problem was that this statute related only to a defendant's current ability to pay for his defense costs, not his future ability to afford to repay the state. In 1990, at the request of the Supreme Court, the legislature amended 1885-120 to allow civil judgments to be entered against defendants who are represented by the public defender without considering the defendant's current ability to pay. If a defendant became solvent at a later date, the judgment could at that time be enforced. If the defendant did not become solvent, obviously the judgment couldn't be enforced. In addition to making this suggested change, the legislature amended the Supreme Court's proposal to prohibit these civil judgments from being entered against defendants who are not actually convicted, and to prohibit execution on a judgment for 3 years after a defendant was released from incarceration. HB 151 basically proposes to change these two amendments which the legislature had made 3 years ago. First, it would allow judgments to be entered against defendants who are represented by the public defender, whether or not the defendant is actually convicted. The philosophy behind this is that non-indigent defendants, the middle class, when they're charged with a crime, have to pay for their defense costs, whether they're convicted or they're acquitted. This bill merely proposes to treat indigent defendants the same way the rest of us would be treated if we were charged with a crime. Second, HB 151 would eliminate the three-year moratorium on repayment that currently follows incarceration. This moratorium makes it substantially more difficult for the state to recover defense costs in a timely manner, and the policy behind it is questionable. There is no reason, for example, to grant a three-year grace period on repayment to a person who gets 3 days in jail for DWI. That person doesn't lose their job. They're not in jail for a substantial period of time. Also, there are many people who obtain substantial incomes almost immediately after leaving prison, and this bill doesn't take account for that fact, nor does it take account, or this statute, rather, doesn't take account for that, nor does the three-year period take account of the fact that virtually everyone in the state receives a permanent fund dividend check each year. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the members might have.
Thank you, Chris. I think before questions, we have one other testimony by teleconference in Anchorage, individual from the Attorney General's office that might answer a question that we would have, and then we would have both of them available for questions. So in Anchorage, if Marilyn May is ready to testify. Hello, Anchorage, is there anybody there? Where's our... Well, while we're waiting, are there any questions for Chris? Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chris, I'd like to know, what kind of volume are we talking about, or what kind of numbers are we talking about, people that would, if we amend the law, would fit under the category of the amendment? Do we have any idea?
Through the chair, Representative Phillips, I think this is something that Ms. May might have the figures on. I do know that in the 6 months or so since this became effective, there was a court rule which implemented the statute. There have been about 1,000 judgments entered against indigent defendants. I did submit for your packets a copy of Criminal Rule 39, which does list the charges that are being made to criminal defendants for various kinds of cases. You can get an idea of what is actually being charged. For example, $5,000 for a murder trial.
Thank you. I'm told that we may have reconnected with Anchorage, and I'll ask if Marilyn May from the Attorney General's office is there and ready to testify.
Yes, I am. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we sure can. Thank you.
Oh, good. I spoke before. I didn't realize you couldn't hear me. As I said, I'm Marilyn May. I'm an assistant attorney general in the Anchorage office, and I'm the attorney for the collections unit, which is a part of the commercial section here in Anchorage. And among our responsibilities is the collection of judgments that are entered under Rule 39, as Chris described. So far, I have somewhat updated figures. We've received, first of all, this rule was just entered and effective as of this fiscal year, so we've just begun to get these judgments. So far, we've received about 1,200 of them, worth about $240,000, and of the 1,200, we've collected, 123 of them have been paid voluntarily, and we've collected a little over $21,000. We're expecting to receive somewhere in excess of 5,000 of these judgments each year, worth in excess of $1 million. And first, I should mention that my comments are directed solely to the aspect of collection of these judgments, and I've not reviewed the statute under any other basis. But I wanted to mention that the statute hampers the collections unit's ability to execute on these judgments. And so far, we've only received about 100 where the court hasn't ruled specifically that good cause exists to allow us to execute sooner than 3 years, but we expect that number, of course, to grow as we get more of these judgments. And it's going to be burdensome for us to collect these judgments, having to keep track of each of the different criminal defendants and when they're coming to consideration. So the bill, as it's written, does not specifically eliminate the possibility that someone might be incarcerated in the future. Language that says execution may not commence until 3 years after release from incarceration is not limited to the incarceration on the offense for which the judgment was entered. And that is another problem that we foresee in the future if someone's going to argue that they've been reincarcerated on another offense and we still can't collect. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Phillips.
Thank you. Ms. May, number one, you answered the first part of the question, but my second part of the question, can you tell us the history of how the fee schedule is set? These are ridiculously low fees. It's just not understandable to me that these fees have been set so low. I'd like an explanation, please.
Well, I was not the person who set those fees, of course, but there was a committee of people that included representatives from the Public Defender's Office and the Office of Public Advocacy, as well as the court system, my office. I can't think who else was involved in that committee. And when the rule was recommended by the committee to the Supreme Court, there was a substantial amount of time spent on determining what would be fair estimate of fees that an indigent person might be able to pay that would help defray the cost of the counsel and yet not be so high that they would not be able to pay it.
I appreciate that background. I just have to make a comment that what is fair, maybe fair to an indigent that's just committed murder, certainly is not fair to the state of Alaska. And as legislators, we need to look at the things that affect the budget of the state of Alaska, and I find this fee schedule completely out of line.
One of the things that was considered, I believe, in determining that fee schedule was that in some cases, very little work is involved, a minimal amount of work before a person, for instance, pleads guilty or makes some kind of other arrangements that doesn't involve going through trial. And I know that was taken into account in the schedule.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you very much, Ms. May. I do not see anyone here. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on 151? Seeing not, what's the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Mr. Christensen.
Representative Norman, question.
Chris, you mentioned the part of the bill that concerns me is that judgments would be, or the cost of defense actually would be collected from a indigent who was later found to not be guilty, for instance. And isn't it true that in a sense that an indigent defendant has a court-appointed attorney assigned to them, whether they like it or not. In other words, that it's not a voluntary thing. Is that correct or not?
Chair, Representative Moreland, Lincoln Elliott from the Attorney General's office might be able to answer that a little more clearly than I can. My understanding is you are asked whether or not you want an attorney. You have a choice. If you say no, you don't get one. The court does have, to an extent, if a case actually goes to trial, the court may be able to impose an attorney on you under certain circumstances. But generally speaking, I believe a person has a right to represent themselves. And particularly has a right to refuse an attorney if they're simply going to plead guilty or something of that nature.
In that case, doesn't the judge sort of make an assessment whether or not that individual is even capable of defending themselves or not?
I believe there is that assessment was made.
Okay, well, I guess the problem I have with this then is that in the example you used where if you would employ a private defense attorney to fight your case, the defendant is, basically taking on, willing to pay that bill. But for an indigent defendant who has an attorney appointed to them and it isn't even voluntarily, and end up having to pay the cost of that defense when in turn they are found to be not guilty or completely innocent of the crime, I have a hard time making that person pay for that defense.
Are there any other questions? Chair would have a comment, I think, on the last. Concern. There is, of course, a distinction between entirely innocent and not found guilty. The standard of establishing guilt is very high, and the fact that a person is not convicted is no established innocence. I guess I would defer to Mr. Quinelli also, but I cannot, in my mind, think of a situation where person has elected to not have an attorney and then been found not guilty. And of course, if they have the benefit of the state's attorney and through the good offices of that attorney are found not guilty, perhaps there is a debt owing.
Well, in this example, I would think that if I was convicted of a crime that I didn't commit, I absolutely was totally innocent of, and I was asked if I wanted to pay for an attorney, whether or not I was convicted or not, I would probably like not to have an attorney appointed to me. And I imagine there's people who go through the criminal justice system that that's true. I mean, there are people that are, innocently accused of a crime. So I don't know if there's some way around that, but I would think that it would not be fair to those individuals who basically have defense costs imposed upon them.
Are there any further questions or comments? Again, yes. Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we make the motion that we move House Bill 151 out of Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection?
I'll object.
There is objection. Could we have a roll call?
Okay. Representative Cott?
Yes.
Representative Northland?
No.
Representative Phillips?
Yes.
Representative Davidson?
No.
Representative James?
Yes.
Representative Porter?
Yes.
Four yeas, nays.
The vote is four yeas and two nays, so we will move 151 with individual recommendations and obviously a zero fiscal note that could be even better than zero. Next, we would like to hear HB 120 and have two people, both here at Anchorage. First, Chris Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Chris Christensen, staff counsel to the Judicial Branch. This is probably, I think, probably the most non-controversial piece of legislation you'll see this session. Currently, the director of the court system is required by law to prepare a list each year for persons who are eligible for jury service. The statute says that this list is all those people who apply for a permanent fund dividend who are otherwise eligible. That's about 250,000 adults each year. Currently, the list must be prepared by March 15th of each year. It's submitted by the Department of Revenue to the court system by the preceding January 15th. The court system has determined that jury service could be administered more efficiently if the jury year corresponded to the calendar year. Accordingly, all HB 120 does is it requires the administrative director to prepare the jury list by November 30th from a list submitted by the Department of Revenue no later than September 30th. And we check with Revenue, and they say the list is ready by that time. There's no additional cost to the state to get it to us in the way. And this will basically just increase our administrative efficiency a little bit without causing anyone any problems.
Thank you, Chris. Again, we have one other person, Tom Williams, from the Department of Revenue Permit Fund Division. Perhaps with that testimony, we can ask questions about it.
Please. My name is Tom Williams. I'm the director of the Permit Fund Division, and as Chris indicated, Mr. Chairman, there is no problem at all with the payment.
Are there any questions of either Chris or Tom?
Thank you. And Chris, in the back of information says during the 17th legislature, the bill died and the Senate Rules Committee did it. Was it a lack of time, ran out of time, there wasn't addressed? All
right. Yes.
I can't imagine. And further comment, Mr. Chairman, since the permanent fund lists and everything have to be turned in by, I believe it's June 30th. Is that the deadline on them? That this would seem like it would be plenty of time in order to get the lists updated.
Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Christensen, I'm wondering why there seems to be in more people than I think is healthy, almost a hostility to serve on the jury. Has the court done anything or any research to find out what is it about serving on the jury system that allows such a development of such an attitude in so many individuals, it seems?
Through the chair, Representative Davidson, I don't know that we've done any formal research. I know I've heard a lot of comments or had other comments reported to me over the years, and I think I know there are a lot of people who dislike having to spend time, take time off from work, not be compensated by their employer, have to arrange for daycare or whatever. People resent the time that they're forced to spend and the expense that it entails.
Are there any further questions? Chair would entertain a motion.
Chairman.
Representative James.
Yes, I move that we move out House Bill number 120 out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing no objection, it is moved as to the motion. Thank you very much. It is 1:30, but the next bill, HJR 15, the sponsor is here who has advised me that it's only a 10-minute operation. So those who are waiting to testify on HB 150, if they will bear with us for what is estimated to be 10 minutes, that will certainly get at you. And so we will then go to HJR 15 and ask for Representative Cott if he would like to introduce his bill.
Absolutely, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's okay by the Chair and the rest of the committee members, I'll do it right from where I'm sitting rather than take the hot seat up front. It is my intent to tell you why this is a good piece of legislation. Now, the idea of reduced session is not a new one, and that's probably what this piece of legislation tries to do, is to reduce the current legislative session from 120 days down to 100 days. From 1975 to 1984, the legislative session did in fact average 146 days. Then the people spoke through a constitutional amendment and required that legislators limit their lawmaking activities to 120 days. And that's where we've been ever since. Since that point in time, the shortest session that we've had has been 119 days. There's been a number of occasions when we have went a little bit longer based on a special session. There's now, I believe, a fairly strong support for an even shorter session. Several measures have been introduced since 1984 that has, in fact, entertained this idea. Previous legislation has run from anywhere, I think, from as short as 60 days up to about 110 days. My resolution is somewhat a moderate approach, as it certainly will satisfy the people's desire while ensuring that we have adequate time to do our lawmaking job well. Currently, there are 26 states that have shorter sessions than Alaska. And granted, Alaska has some very unique problems, but I think it seems fairly prudent as well as reasonable to ask us to get our work done as expeditiously as possible. Most of us during recent campaign have in fact advocated legislative reform, not fiscal restraint measures. And I think think this is one method that will, again, indicate to the public that we mean business in cutting the budget. This particular measure, if passed and presented to the voters, which I'm fairly certain it would be approved, will in fact save the state of Alaska approximately $1 million in today's dollars. So I would ask you to move this resolution through the committee and let the people have the final say. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Cott. Do you anticipate any other testimony?
I don't believe there are any additional folks that are going to testify on this. We had this is the second hearing for it, and we had some testimony earlier.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several questions on this resolution. And, we know that democracy is not necessarily an efficient way of carrying out the business, but certainly when it comes to the public's business, why should we get hasty? And I know that I've been here long enough to realize that some things can be done in 120 days, some things can be done in a much shorter period of time. But I would ask the representative, what are the specific reasons for this, aside from the intent of saving money, and what is to prevent the legislature from, this legislature right now, from finishing its work in 85 days, or whichever number you want to choose. It all depends on what comes on the plate, and why and how it gets on the plate. And my inclination is to say, why put any further artificial restraints on our ability to do business? If the law says get out of here in 100 days, that's fine, but does it make for hasty legislation? I'm just not convinced that, we want to hurry the business of the state, considering especially that we are a young state, and that I just have not heard, nor have I seen the reasons that convince me that such resolutions are necessary at this time.
Representative Cott, respond.
I may respond. Certainly, during the campaign season, you obviously aren't perhaps knocking on the same doors or hearing the same thing that I've heard over the 3 months of campaigning, because most public believes that we're spending too much time deliberating. And certainly democracy is a very deliberative process. It was never supposed to be efficient or as swift as a swallow. But nonetheless, I think that we can look, and having been here a short 43 days, I think I could illustrate a few examples where we could cut the legislative process already. Prior to 1984, when we had no limitation on the session, we were averaging 146 days. Once there's a limitation placed on us, all of a sudden we're doing our business in 120 days. In the shortest, it's been 119 days. So I would suggest that, barring at least overlooking the fiscal impact of this legislation, I think when you look at it from a practical standpoint, sometimes we are here doing more than what we should be doing. We have 120 days, and we can certainly facilitate or plant the seed that will extend it and utilize the full 120 days up, given the opportunity. We all like to be in session, apparently. Right now, we have a moderate, I think, proposal that has been presented by the majority caucus that's calling for us to get out of here in less than 120 days, about 110 days. If we meet that, then hats off to us, but I think there's even further room. And this is what the people is calling for. From the Daily News to the governor, they've all suggested that we can do the business of the state in less time than currently.
Representative James?
I would like to kind of do a balancing act, I guess, in between the parties here. As a freshman legislator, and having been here some 40-some days, and I see that there are a lot of things that could do to be speeding up the process, but I'm a little bit distressed as well as some of the speed by which things do go through. And some of the examples might be the budget reserve account that we're dealing with now. I think that maybe when that law passed, that we didn't do careful enough analysis of exactly what should have been in that document, and now we wouldn't be having the distress that we have of trying to argue who's how it should be. I think that we take passing legislation too lightly. I think that we need to take close deliberation, and with the passing of all of the paperwork that's gone by my desk now, I can't honestly say that I'm familiar with every bill that's on the deck. And I think that somehow or other we do need to be responsible, and we do need to understand exactly every bill that's on the deck. Let me say also that as I was running for office, I met those same people that the Representative Cox speaking about. The people of the state of Alaska do not have a good feeling for their legislators. We are people who are just taking their money and doing absolutely zippo with it. They're not happy with anything we do, and I don't think necessarily bringing back the deadline for getting the session done to 100 days is going to change that one bit. I think that it behooves us as elected representatives of this state to take our job more seriously and do a better finite job. And I don't think necessarily bringing the legislation back to 100 days will do that. I think that if this bill were to be laid out there for the general public, you bet they'll vote for it 100%. I'm not totally convinced that we need to give them that opportunity. I think we need to prove our worth in some other way.
Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My grandfather was in the territorial legislature, and I tried to pick his brain before he passed away to find out how long their sessions were and what their focus was when they were in the legislature for the territory of Alaska. And you know, the citizens came from all over the state then. They came by dog sled. There weren't the modes of transportation that we have today, and it was a real hardship for people to come here in those days. And normally the session didn't last over 60 days. I believe the territorial law was for 60 days. And I asked him, was there ever the need to go over? Did you ever extend your sessions? They said, and his reply was, we didn't have to. We didn't have enough to do. We didn't have any money to spend. No, we didn't need to be here then. But the basic premise of the territorial legislature and the legislature today in Alaska is that the Alaska State Legislature is made up of citizen legislators. And in 1970, when we saw the length of the sessions extended so far that being a legislator was not open to everybody in Alaska, it became a very discriminatory factor. Because many citizens could not then become a legislator because they could not be away from their jobs and their responsibilities for the length of time that the sessions went in the early 70s and into the 80s. And I would say whatever we can do as a legislative body today, the public is saying, you are a citizen's legislator. We have not made you professional. We have not made you full-time. We don't want you to be full-time professional legislators. This is the first step in bringing it back down to opening up the whole legislative process to everybody in Alaska. And certainly 100 days is not going to do it. There's a lot of people. There are a lot of teachers and such that cannot participate because of that time frame. But maybe it'll make it a little better and less discriminatory for some people in Alaska.
Thank you, Representative Phillips. Representative Cutt?
I might add, since the representative from the Homer area brought out another point, we have come a long ways in the last decade. And certainly computer technology in itself should at least facilitate us getting our job done earlier than what we've been doing. I mean, how often have you called over to Legislative Affairs and asked for a draft, and it's there within a couple hours? You know, years ago, that would have been impossible. We've got access to various software programs on the computer. Right from your very desk, you can access a bill and find out where it faltered last legislature during the last session. And that was unheard of as short as 6 years ago. Now, those type of things, I think, now are available that will speed up the process. And you know, as we talked about, democracy was never supposed to be swift, but I would submit that if we do nothing else in the 18th legislature, if we get the budget out, that one document, the people back home will be certainly jumping for joy.
Representative Davidson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's still, I think, a lot to be said about this bill, or this resolution, to shorten the length of time that we deliberate in the democratic mode. And I am not going to be one who jumps for joy. I mean, after all, we've been here 45 days, and we still haven't appointed members to the Ethics Committee. Now, I don't know if that means that we aren't doing our job or what, but just point that out to indicate that, you know, some things take longer than others. And there is absolutely nothing, even with all that nice new technology out there, that says we can't get out of here sooner. My simple point is, you know, why do we want to put it in statute, or why do we want to make a constitutional amendment that says, this is when you will be done with your work? I mean, it's nonsensical as far as I'm concerned because, you know, the great public out there, in fact, does not know what the nitty-gritty is down here. I mean, I know in my own district, and I'm sure many people in all the other districts don't even realize that you're part of the legislature. They call you congressman sometimes. Other times, they'll see you in the middle of summer and say, oh, you're back from Juneau already? You know, so, you know, I think that, well, I certainly give the public a lot of credence and a lot of ability to see what the rascals are doing. The everyday issues and the everyday give and take and the compromises and the discussions are not noted by the public out there in great detail. And there's another point, Mr. Chairman, I think is worthy to bring out here. When the legislature's away, the executive plays. And I've watched it in the times that I have been here, and we are sometimes less than little mice with the big cat in the executive chair at times. And I'm not talking about a Republican, I'm not talking about a Democrat, I'm talking about three branches of government, and we all have got to have some access to do the work that we've been sent to do by the people that we've been sent to do it. Lord knows there's not a whole lot of understanding out there in the way our democracy works and the interworkings of this very process as we come to Juneau. But I do think it is ludicrous to think that just because everybody is clamoring, whether it's at the newspapers or anybody else, get your work. Hey, we can still do the work. We could have been out of here 5 days ago if that's what we wanted to do. But I think that we're taking the time to understand what are those issues. And we got to look at these things. And the checks and balance argument, I think, is a worthy one. So, well, I'm not going to jump for joy for any particular reason here. I know it's a long, slow, and arduous process. And the more artificial restrictions that we place on the players, the more foolish it will become down here. Because, like I say, nothing prevents us from getting the job done early and going home. And, the more we establish confinement of what we can and how we should do it and when we should do it and what time we should do it, I think democracy and true debate and deliberation loses out. And that's not good for any democracy.
Thank you, Representative Jameson. Are there any other comments or questions? Representative Cott, recognizing it.
Geez, I've already used up my 10 minutes and I apologize, but I just can't hold myself back from responding at least to one comment that my colleague has made. Due respect, if in fact, while the legislature is the way the executive plays, maybe we ought to be expanding the legislative process to include the other 200 plus days that we have available. I would submit that's not what we should be doing, and I think when you look at it, we'll use as much time as we have constitutionally available to us. That's the bottom line. Look at the previous sessions. The last minute, on the last day, we passed legislation just to get out of here, to meet the mandate. That's levied on us. So I would suggest that all you have to do is take a look at the 16 Saturdays and 4 holidays, subtract that from this current session, and you have 100 days.
Thank you, Representative Cott. I guess since everybody's commented, I will. Except Jim, you got one coming if you'd like. I will have to admit personally that I was, I heard reduced the length of session from people in my district. I felt that that was an appropriate thing when I came down here, and quite frankly, since I've been here, now I'm not so sure. One of our members has got a statement that he likes to make that I think in this case for me is true. Some of my friends think we should, some of my friends think we shouldn't, and I agree with my friends. I'm going to recognize the discussions that I had and the statements that I made prior to getting here, and support moving this along, and it will be very interesting, the discussions that will take place subsequently. It could be, I recognize the need to recognize, being a freshman, that this process that we're in is not supposed to be efficient, or I guess that's not the proper thing to say, but it's not designed to be quick. There are checks and balances within this one branch. Perhaps if we spend enough time on each individual thing, as Representative James suggested we should do, which I totally agree, we wouldn't have as many things to consider. We wouldn't have as large an impact every year on the state. So with that in mind, I would certainly entertain a motion.
I move that we pass this bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection?
Objection.
There is objection. Roll call vote, please.
Representative Norland?
Yes.
Representative Phillips?
Yes.
Representative Davidson?
No.
Representative Cott?
Yes.
Vice Chair James?
Yes.
Chairman Porter?
Yes.
5 years, 1 day.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Davidson?
Yes, if I may. This is the second SWIFT constitutional amendment that we've seen pass out of this committee. And if I may, I'd just like to make a statement for the record to indicate my concern here. I'd like to hear a little bit more about those 26 states that have these kinds of restrictions. I'm sorry I didn't make it to the last meeting, I don't think. I don't know how many people were here to give input, but in this committee, we are the keepers of the keys that truly make the laws in the judiciary sense. And it would be my hope that if we're going to pass on constitutional amendments as so much candy to the people, that we would have more effort on all perspectives of the issue to ensure that we do have sufficient discussion. I know that all of us on this committee took great value in the efforts of Judge Stewart when he reminded us of some of the weaknesses in the, thank goodness, constitutional amendment that we didn't quickly pass out of this committee. And I don't know, had he not been here, what this committee would have done. But that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And let's hear from some of those citizens that we've knocked on their doors, and they're very adamant about this. Let's find out if they have a more thorough understanding of the process than what we believe. Let's get these issues up and look at them from every perspective, because I can honestly say that in my experience as a chairman, I've always surprised, generally, that there's always a perspective we did not understand or did not examine, and we were too quick. And we still have a few days left in this session, despite the fact that we haven't done some of the things that you would think would not take so much time to do. But I just, for the record, Mr. Chairman, note that concern of mine. Hasty constitutional amendments chip at the very foundations upon which our government is built. And as far as I'm concerned, we have not had sufficient examination of this constitutional amendment in this committee. And if it's not going to get it in this committee, I seriously doubt that it's going to get it in any other committee. Again, you know, our Constitution is the foundation upon which our government is built. And to hurriedly undermine the foundation of that government and that structure upon which it is built, I think is irresponsible. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Davidson. I'm sorry. I cannot find any disagreement with your statements. I, too, was surprised that after due notification that there were not more people willing to anxious to testify on this particular issue. I think it will get an awful lot of discussion between now and it being on the floor, and if it were to pass the floor, certainly we'll get an awful lot of discussion before the public has an opportunity to indicate their preference. I certainly appreciate your comments. Okay, late, but we did it. We now have the time for HB 100, and ask if Representative Bundy, the sponsor, would step forward.
No, I changed
tell
my
us
mind.
Who he is, sing as we speak.
Thank you, Chairman Porter. You have before you HB 100 in discussion with a good many people. The bottom line that I hope to achieve and hope to convince you to address is to change our juvenile criminal justice system to be more productive. I think, to quote a police officer I talked to recently, that most of the young people think our juvenile justice system is a joke, it's a cakewalk. And as you are, many of you are very aware, the sophistication of our young people today is much greater than it was 20 or 30 years ago. the opportunities, the options, the decisions that young people must make today are vastly more complex than they were 20 or 30 years ago. The rights of young people, I think, are addressed very clearly. Many young people are far more aware of their rights than 20 or 30 years ago. However, I don't think there's been an equal focus on the responsibility of young people. It's a vital concern to me, I think, as an educator, as a parent, as a citizen, that young people be made very aware of what the boundaries are of acceptable behavior, and that we do them a great disservice if we send soft or fuzzy messages, contradictory messages, that at age 17, 11 months, you can do some very serious crime and be judged as a juvenile, but at age 18, you suddenly will become an adult and treated far more severely. I think we are encouraging our young people to develop through accident, not intent, into career criminals at young age, because once they're 18 and commit the same kind of crime that they got away with at 17, and they go into the adult system, that things change for them very seriously, and it's often then it's too late to have a change of behavior for them. We need to intervene early on to encourage them to change their behavior when they are doing antisocial kind of things in the hopes of changing them. I think most of us realize that in the adult criminal justice system, we have an incredible rate of recidivism, and that we're not doing much to change our behavior as adults, so we've got to intervene earlier. As it is, I think the statistics I got in McLaughlin, there's a 50% recidivism rate now in our juvenile system, higher than 50%. And so it's not working. We've got to change it. One of the suggestions that I have for changing it is 100 that will encourage, will allow young people to be tried as adults for felonies and major crimes. So this is not an attempt to abuse our youth by treating them unfairly. I think it's an attempt to encourage a fair and equitable treatment of our young adults and encourage them to become responsible citizens rather than send them the kind of message that through misunderstanding gets them in serious adult trouble with the law. You have a number of people that would like to testify. If I might ask your indulgence and say, I guess I'd like to hear their testimony, and I'd like you to hear their testimony, and then when they've finished with their testimony, make myself available for questions. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Are there any, in light of that, are there any questions that we need to ask Representative Bundy at this point, or should we?
Well, I would just like to ask one thing.
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In light of the fact that recently in Britain we've seen even 16 as an old person as far as some of the things you're talking about. So why 16? Why not 10?
Are you suggesting an amendment?
I'm not suggesting an amendment. What I'm trying to do is to find out why you said 10 and what is the basis for which you decided that 16.
I haven't chosen 16. Actually, I chose 15. In my experience dealing with young people, I feel most 10-year-olds don't have sufficient judgment to ask them to be tried as adults. The people that I've talked with in the criminal justice system, it seems that by the time you're 14, 15 years old, we'll have a better grasp of what's right now.
So what's the magic age at which a child accomplishes magic judgment? I mean, what is the magic age at which a child acquires this judgment?
Well, I think we've met many children of 30 and 40 who haven't reached that magic age yet, but maybe it's because they weren't encouraged to be responsible at 15.
So the question then is, how does this help a 16-year-old, how are we going to, what we're trying to do here is deal with people after the fact. It seems that the effort should be made to deal with children before the fact, and I guess I'd be very interested in the people that we hear to testify, but I do have some other questions for the response, and I look forward to that after that.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, just one general response, and that if I guess to believe that this bill might work, you have to have the basic belief in the criminal justice system that if certain behaviors are punished, they're not apt to be repeated. And so if they're punished at age 15, they're not apt to be repeated at age 30.
Thank you, Representative Bundy. I will mention that we have Dean Guinelli from the Department of Law here to answer questions if they come up on the specifics of the bill. And next, I would like in Anchorage to ask if Jay Page is present to testify.
Yes, I am. Committee members, Representative Bundy, my name is Jay Page. I am the chairman of the Anchorage Chamber Crime Prevention Committee, chairman-elect of Junior Achievement of Alaska. I have consulted in classes at McLaughlin Youth Center, and I'm on the board of the Boys and Girls Club, and I've worked with the school district and Anchorage Police Department for a number of years trying to implement the kind of prevention program that one of the representatives down there was just discussing, the police school liaison program in the Anchorage School District. Unfortunately, due to budget problems and constraints and other priorities, that's not an effective program in the city at this time. However, I would like to thank Representative Bundy for introducing House Bill 100 and a number of other bills that he has introduced. Our committee is supportive of House Bill 100. But first, I would like to just expand a little bit on what Representative Bundy had to say regarding juvenile law in the state of Alaska. As most of you know, if not all of you, that juvenile law is embodied in Title 47. And the basic premise of Title 47 is that juveniles do not have sufficient capacity to understand the outcomes of their actions and their cognizance of what they're doing. So juveniles of all ages, up to 18, can only commit crime-like activity. They cannot commit a crime. And the only sanction in the juvenile system is rehabilitation, and there is no sanction for any punishment. As the representative said, McLaughlin, I got the number 48 for percent recidivism there. It could well be 50. It's anybody's guess, but what's going on isn't working. That's a whole other item, but I think what I'm trying to say is that the nature of the juvenile today is not the nature of the juvenile when this entire body of law was written 30 years or more ago. What we're seeing today are not kids that aren't cognizant of what they're doing, but we're seeing kids, a whole class of kids, an expanding class of kids across the world. You mentioned the incident in England with two 10-year-olds killing a 2-year-old. Across the entire world where we're raising kids without consciences. I think Ralph Samuels was here last week to testify on this. His brother 3 years ago was shot through the head. My 16-year-old had knocked on his door with a .357 that committed that murder for no other reason than he wanted the sports car in the driveway. These are kids that don't care. And it's a real shame that we couldn't get to them when they were in a dysfunctional situation growing up, possibly, that things couldn't have been more positive for them when they were growing up. And I think that is something that we really need to focus on, is getting at the root causes of these problems. But in the meantime, you need to deal with what is already out there, what is expanding and what is getting worse. And HB 100 is a step in that direction. Now this bill, which would shift the responsibility for proving amenability to rehabilitation from the state and to the juvenile, is necessary if for no other reason than the recent court decision 2 years ago.
Three, line 25 to 27 language, that is a switch that's being made right now. That same language is appearing in our terroristic threatening statute 1156.810, and it's being moved in this bill from terroristic threatening to assault in the incurred degree, and the language is being moved wholesale. No amendments have been made to it, and it may be appropriate to take this opportunity to clean it up, but it's been on the books for a number of years that way. And we're just trying to move that conduct from a place that doesn't make a lot of sense, terroristic threatening, to a place where you would expect to find it, which is in the assault statutes.
And then finally, I have a concern where, and I may have misunderstood this, but we're talking about a weapon or a threat of a weapon. And I can see a situation we heard from a male, that was being stalked by a female. And most of us, I think, the male gender, if I look around this room, for example, could very likely disarm a female with a knife. On the other hand, I look around this room, and there are very, I would think there are a lot of cases where a male, because of his superior size and strength, could do not only bodily harm, but could kill a female without a weapon. And I'm wondering, is there any way to, I mean, is there a significant difference between some guy that threatens to strangle or the other guy, no, he's got to have a gun in his pocket?
There are cases where the Court of Appeals has ruled that your feet can be a dangerous instrument. But short of that, the law does like to make these distinctions on the basis of whether there's a weapon or not a weapon, and the law is extremely reluctant to make gender-based distinctions. And I agree that in reality you could have an unarmed male who is more dangerous than a woman with a knife, but I cannot think of a constitutional way to differentiate it.
Thank you. Representative Green, I feel compelled to say that I've been on the wrong end of a couple of knives and it really didn't make any difference to gender. Are there any other questions?
I have a couple.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Now we're getting late. Well, must be getting late.
I just have some sort of, I guess, questions of a technical nature. On the first page, where is it? The bottom, the citation is AS 2535. Is that a temporary restraining order?
I believe so.
Okay. And so, in other words, to part, you would have to be in violation of a TRO in the case of a stalking in the first degree. Is that, but it doesn't seem that that's true all in the case of the stalking in the second degree.
Correct.
No, why is that?
The offense is set up so that the misdemeanor stalking in the second degree occurs simply when you recklessly place somebody in fear of death or physical injury. The aggravator, if you will, of doing that when a judge has already told you to stay away from that person is going to elevate it to a felony offense.
I see. Okay. And then you answered my question about sections 2 and 3 and what they're doing there, just reclassifying the name of the crime. Also, let's see. In section 4, it allows a police officer to arrest a person who's committed stalking, crime stalking in the second degree without a warrant. Would that be allowed also if you committed crime stalking in the first degree?
Since that one's a felony, warrantless arrest,
okay.
are
right.
authorized.
I get it.
I know, I looked at one person. No, wait a minute.
Okay, and then finally, why is it that for these crimes, as the same with a few other crimes of law, that you just follow SIS and initial sentence? But I think that's section 6. Yeah, section 6.
An SIS allows the defendant to have the conviction taken off of his or her record. And that means that that there's no record kept that this person has committed this type of offense. Initially, there was a concern that with particularly sex offenses, that the system should always be able to identify this person as a sex offender, and that we didn't want to create a situation where that information could essentially be hidden. It is a policy call where you want to draw the line on what type of offenses should a person be able to remove from their record of convictions and which ones you do not. I can tell you the police will always know whether you were arrested for any offense. It doesn't come out of the law enforcement agency's computer information, but access to that information is very tightly controlled, and the general public is not going to know what those records show. So this has to do with whether the general public will be able to know that a defendant has been convicted of stalking forever or not.
Would this perhaps be because these characters are more likely to repeat that kind of offense? It's not such sort of an isolated pattern?
I think that's the analysis.
Are there any other questions? We have one more person that wants to testify, Deborah Luper.
First, though, let me say that I'm in full support of the concept of this bill, and as you probably know, the senator that I work for also sponsored a bill. He's the prime sponsor of a bill on the Senate side, Senate Bill 22. But I have some concerns about a few portions of the bill that I think need to be addressed. First of all, I would like to see a definition of the word repeated. Does repeated mean more than once, or does it mean three or four times? My other concern is, as Representative Phillips so kindly brought up, I would like to play devil's advocate for a moment, and let's consider the case of the Greens Creek mine. You have a potential there that was a managerial decision to close down that mine and shut down effectively about 230 jobs. Conceivably, that could raise a lot of concern and anger among those workers. They have the constitutionally protected right of being able to assemble and to picket and to protest. My concern is that in the course of this protest, you might have some high feelings there, and the manager approaches the building where the assembly is, and there's a lot of screaming, shouting picketers. This bill says where a person knowingly engages in a course of conduct, and course of conduct, there's a definition there that says approaching or confronting that person in a public place or on private property. The Greens Creek Mine property would fall under that. And it goes on to say that recklessly places another person in fear of death or physical injury. Now, when I was a police officer in Fairbanks for some time, and the definition of physical injury then, and I checked it again in the statute, and what it means now is if your toe gets stuck down and you feel pain, that it qualifies for physical injury. So, conceivably, the manager of the Greens Creek Mine might be approaching his building, and there's picketers there, and they're screaming and shouting, and he has to push his way through. Conceivably, if he's placed in fear of having his toe stepped on, he can have someone arrested for stalking. Now, if you look again, say this person is released, and he goes right back out there, and he commits the crime again the next day or the next week or whatever, he's up for a felony. And I think that's a very dangerous precedent to set. I think that portion needs to be worked on, that this bill will allow all constitutionally, or will very clearly state that constitutionally protected acts are allowed. And in fact, page 2, and lines 18 and 19, I would advocate that instead of the simple physical injury, that we use the verbiage serious physical injury. That, of course, is much worse. It involves broken limbs, etc. We may also wish to, as was mentioned earlier, have a definition of fear, and perhaps go into a little bit more into the intent of delivering an object on property. This bill does address husbands and boyfriends, and conceivably husband and wife will own the same property. And if he delivers an object to his property, even though perhaps he has a court order not to be there when his wife is there, but say he delivers a car, parks it on the property, or whatever, an object, you want to make certain that an innocent act that will not be penalized.
Whatever to that one point, I believe that there's a court order saying you stay off the property. There is no innocent act coming on the property. So that one would be just certainly take a look at the rest of them. Are there any other questions? Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Say on the example of a strange couple, and the husband wants to take this car onto the property. Would there be an opportunity for that person to ask permission of the court to do that kind of thing? Could you do that through regulation? Or, I don't know. I mean, it seems like this lady has brought up a very good point.
As a practical matter, I think I would have somebody else deliver the car, but I would say not a lot of overall violation of court. I assume that you could petition the court for that. I would guess that the court would look at that as a continuation of harassment and legitimate request since there are other means to do it. Go for the questions. Thank you very much. Are there any other points of consideration or concern or discussion? I'm looking both ways now. I'm making sure I'm getting everybody. Okay, what we will do then is try to incorporate as many as possible of these suggestions, and after discussions with those who have made them and the other players that they might affect, and we'll try to get a bill out just as soon as we can, but we'll pass it on to everybody and try to highlight those
conclusions that we've made, and with the intent of getting back here and consider it again as soon as we can. If there's nothing else to come before us, anybody? Meeting time?
Overtime.
I'm sorry. Yes, I did. Unfortunately, while I still have you here, we seem to be having a problem getting people here at 1 o'clock. Are there any of you that are here that have a commitment regularly at 3 o'clock on Blessed Friday? What I'm wondering is if it wouldn't be more advantageous for us to start the meeting at 1:30.
No.
I have asked.
You have asked at 3?
I have problems frequently, not all the time.
Well, then let me just ask, especially when we have teleconferences, if we can try to make a concerted effort to get here at 1, because we have an awful lot of people out there waiting for us to start. The dollar going along and the teleconference charges. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.